Welcome to Flipped,
the Irish Animation Podcast.
Hi, I'm Megan.
Hi, I'm Aidan.
Welcome to the fifth episode of Flipped. I just want to thank everybody for liking our Facebook page and giving us so much support through Twitter. We really, really appreciate it, as always, and hope you continue to enjoy the podcast.
Yes, indeed. This month's interview is with Jason Tamamagi. He's a creator, writer, producer and director of children's animation. He currently specialises in preschool animation. So he created this preschool show, Fluffy Gardens, and his new show has just hit the airwaves and it's called Planet Cosmo.
He has worked extensively for Geronimo Productions, serving as their creative director for the last 13 years. Geronimo recently changed its name and was formerly known as Monster Animation.
Yeah, so if you hear him talk about Monster and you hear him talking about Geronimo, they're the same company. So let's just...
let's go for it and stay tuned for our competition winner announcement.
Enjoy! I am here in the offices of Geronimo Animation and I am joined by Jason Tamamagi. Hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for doing this. Really
appreciate it.
So I think the easiest way to start with these things is to start at the start, I suppose.
Yeah.
So you went to Ballyfermot, did you?
I went to Ballyfermot, that's right. I studied there for 3 years.
Okay.
3 years. I dropped out of university. I was doing sciences in university, and I had, because I'd know it, nobody told me you could make cartoons for a living. They don't tell you this in school, and I was doing sciences, physics, chemistry, maths, and it wasn't working for me. I loved being in Trinity College. It was great fun. It's a great place to be, but I kind of knew by the end of the year this wasn't going to work. And a friend of mine told me about this animation course he was applying to, and I was like, I didn't even know such a thing existed. So I applied, and I blagged my way in with the interview. I do remember the guy who interviewed me, like, mentioning a couple of names, and like, do you like the work of such and such? And I'm like, yes, absolutely. And I was like, I had to go look them up afterwards. But I got in, and a couple of weeks into it, I knew this is for me.
Brilliant.
I absolutely love this.
Excellent.
So yeah, it was good.
Great stuff. And then, so I think one thing that students are always interested in, I know I was interested in a student, is how you make the leap to that first gig then out of college. How did that happen for you?
Well, my first job was actually at the end of second year.
Okay.
And basically it was the day after, I think the day after we finished second year, I brought my portfolio to animation studios, and by that stage what happened was Bluth just collapsed. I don't know if they would say they collapsed, they relocated,
but, yeah, of course. Yes.
Yeah, you know, as far as we were concerned, Bluth collapsed. Yeah. And so I ended up actually going to Monster Animation and hoping I would get, you know, maybe an in-between job or a cleanup job, but they needed animators. And they said, would you... it was actually Jared, who's the producer here, said, you know, let's try you out as an animator. And great. I was terrified. Yeah. I was not ready to be an animator. But I did that, and I managed to survive. That was on The Willows in Winter.
Okay.
Which was for TVC in London. It was, we were doing service work on that. So that was classical animation. Mm-hmm. And I struggled. I was out of my depth, but I managed to not get fired, which was, you know, that really was the big leap then made, was actually not getting fired. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a great way to learn.
Yeah.
You know, getting into absolutely. That position that's too difficult, and then figuring out how you stay in that position, it's a great way to learn. Yeah. So I was only there on that production for a few months, but I came out of that a lot better than I went in.
Yep.
And so it was kind of similar after I did third year, because I had worked with Jared, and he knew that this Norwegian company needed animators for Norway's first classically animated feature.
Oh, wow.
And so I ended up getting a job on that. I actually missed, I think, the last day of college because I was on a plane over to Norway.
Excellent.
On that. And again, there I was one of the weaker animators. I was still new, and there were people there who'd been animating for 10 years, 20 years on big productions. Yeah, and so that was a real struggle, but again, a great learning experience. Mm. And I picked up a huge amount of things there that really stayed with me for many years later. And even picked up some things that didn't fully make sense until, you know, 5 years afterwards.
Okay. Like,
things would sort of start to click, and I think back to those experiences and think, yeah, that's why this worked, or that's why this didn't work.
Oh, you know?
So sometimes things... I find a lot of times lessons take time to really
to sink in.
Yeah, to really make sense. You kind of need even more experience. I think experience makes such a huge difference.
Yeah, and, yeah.
Seeing different things and different ways of doing things, and you start to just put little pieces together eventually. And,
yeah.
You know, even in terms of how I got those jobs, because I do remember thinking, and I used to say to people all the time, I used to say I was so lucky and I was that I was in the right place at the right time. You know, I walked into that job initially and got it, and that was a real right time, right place, right time scenario. It was only years later, after kind of seeing a lot of other people do things and you know, with me also trying certain things and some of them working and not working,
yeah, of course, yeah,
that I kind of realized that I kept saying it was right place and right time, but really you've got to get yourself into the right place for a start. That requires action. You can make that happen.
Yeah.
You know, you can get yourself into the right place, but you've also got to be at a certain level that you are willing and able to take the opportunities when they arise.
Yeah.
You know, so you can't control all the external factors, but you can definitely get active about things yourself.
Yeah.
And make things happen.
That's right. A friend of mine who's a big surfer, he compares it to surfing. He's like, well, I see this wave coming and I'm going to try and swim it and I'm going to try and get it. But if something else happens in the meantime, then you know what I mean? But I'm sort of ready for that one. But
that's exactly it. Yeah. And you've got to be ready for it.
Yeah.
You've got to be ready for it when it comes. And I've seen that happen a lot, even for myself, but I've seen it happen with others, that people actually get offered opportunities that they've really dreamed of for years, and yet they don't take them, you know, and it's because they're not ready, you know, or they suddenly feel this fear.
Yes.
You know? And I've had that. You know, I've dropped certain projects very early on in my career, basically out of fear that back in the day I probably perceived as fear of failure, whereas in actual fact it was probably the opposite. It was fear of success. You know, it was suddenly now there's pressure. And there's
expectations,
and there's this huge workload of new things, and that can be overwhelming, and it can be quite difficult.
Yeah,
so, you've got to be in a place where you're ready to take those opportunities when they come.
Yeah, definitely. Good. Well, that was it was a great opportunity. Yeah, because I know people who wouldn't, when we graduated, wouldn't move to other countries, isn't there? So even being ready to go to Norway or whatever, in itself is sort of a mindset.
Yeah.
So you were there for like a year?
I was in Norway for probably just under a year.
Okay.
And that was, on a classically animated feature. Apparently did spectacularly well in Norway.
Okay.
I think more people went to see it than actually live in the country. So
wow.
You know, many people went to see it several times. Wow. I don't know if it ever made it outside Norway, but it was a crazy film. But it was fun. It was fun. It was a frustrating process at times because it was Norway's first classically animated feature. So even the people at top level had a real learning curve. Some of it was crazy, but it was really good. It was really good for me at that time.
Excellent. Very good. And then you came back here then?
I came back here and I did a lot of bits and pieces, small things. I did animation for some short films. I did character design. I did stuff for pitches. I did some storyboarding as well.
Okay.
A lot of very small things. Now, they all kind of counted later, but there was quite a bit of just trying a lot of different things. And then ended up back in Monster Animation when really Monster dropped the kind of service production model.
Okay.
Because really, when I joined, they were a really big studio and they were doing service work for features and TV features. Mm. But that line of work always brings the same problems, which is that you're crewing up and crewing down. And, you know, if the next production isn't lined up, there could be a gap and you've got overheads that are just eating you away. So Monster was beginning to look at new ways of doing things, and so what we did then was we got into the commercials market, which is a lot smaller. You don't need the big crews.
Yes, productions, of course. Yeah,
productions
yeah.
are quicker. Ads, at least in that time, paid well for the amount of work that went in.
Yeah.
And they weren't as large a commitment. So we made ads for quite a number of years, and that was a very good way of developing new skills and new ways of animating. Because every ad is different.
Yeah,
and, you know,
you
know, 6 weeks later, you're on a completely different ad. And nobody wants the exact same as you did before. They're not going to say, well, give us the same as you, you know, the ad you did for this crowd, because they don't want that. They want their own identity. They want they want to push their brand in their ways. So there was quite a bit of R&D that happened there, and finding different ways of making animation. And so I picked up quite a lot of different animation skills through that. And we were introduced to Flash through that as well.
Right.
It was doing webisodes in the kind of early days of Flash cartoons. Mm-hmm. And we did these cheese strings webisodes, and we were looking at them, and they were, you know, I'm not going to say they were good, but in terms of what we could actually make with this stuff,
yes.
you know, we'd look
yeah,
at it and go, well, we can do that for broadcast.
Yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
know, if you remove, because we were working with the limitations of the web.
Yes.
But if you remove the limitations of the web, what could we do for broadcast?
Yeah.
And so we did a Lotto ad in Flash.
Okay.
And this was very early on in the Flash days. I don't know how many people, if any, were doing Flash for broadcast at this time.
Wow.
But we decided to try a Lotto ad in Flash, and it worked really well.
Okay.
And I kind of left classical animation behind on that day. It was like, this making films a frame at a time, that's a mug's game. You know?
Drawing every single one of these
Yes, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that hooked me into Flash. And I just saw the potential there. Like, we were just making, this was just a 30-second ad, but in my head it was like, this is TV shows, this is features, this is, you know, suddenly you can do all these things. And when I very first learned Flash, I went home, and it was a weekend, and on a Sunday afternoon, I made a little Flash cartoon from start to finish.
Yeah.
And just the thought of being able to do that before those tools, you know, I wouldn't need a studio with 30 people.
Yeah.
I could do it in an afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
And it kind of changed everything for me, really.
Yeah.
It was a big, big awakening to this whole other way of working. Now, it doesn't work for everything, and I still adore classical animation.
Mm.
But I guess at that point, it was becoming very clear to me that I wasn't going to be content just being an animator.
Ah, of course. I was going to ask you that. So the commercials you are animating on or directing, or
the commercials
kind of up and down?
What happened with the commercials was I was effectively animating a lot of them solo.
Oh, right. Okay.
And it occurred to me at one point that pretty much meant I was directing them. So basically one day I started calling myself a director, and nobody really objected. You know, nobody came to my house and demanded to see my credentials.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So,
or is there a director's certificate? Yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of the story of how I became a director. But yeah, I loved telling stories, and I loved entertaining and just giving more than just, it was more about the storytelling than just the animation itself.
Okay,
you know?
Yes.
Animation is such a great skill and can be refined, and you can get better and better and better at it. But I kind of wanted to take a broader view and really got into that storytelling thing.
Yeah.
Which is where at that point, some of those earlier skills I'd picked up and the little bitty jobs actually turned out to be really valuable.
Yeah.
You know, the character design and the storyboarding and stuff like that, that at the time were somewhat frustrating because they were small, little, you know, unrelated jobs. And yet, when it was time to be a director, I actually had this very good broad view of how all the different parts of the process work.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was very beneficial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
It was a big help.
Fantastic. And then, so now you're a director. Is that when you started making the sort of short films like the Irish Flash and all this kind
That's
of
right.
stuff?
That's right.
Yeah,
would have been around that time. That was 2004-ish, 2005.
Yeah, because I was looking at the other night, and the thing, like, Night Out or Not There Yet, which is great, or Dublin One, which is brilliant. Is Dublin One a Frameworks?
Yes, that's right. It was a Frameworks, yeah.
But the thing that struck me slightly was that, having known you from Fluffy Gardens and Planet Cosmo and all these kind of things, actually they're quite adult in a way.
They are quite, yes, they are. They're and they had to be. I think certainly with Frameworks, it was specifically for an adult audience.
Yeah, because you've got this great bit at the end of Dublin One where he asks if he can curse.
That's right. That's right. They were for adults, and those short films were really experiments.
Yes, they're very expressive, and they are sort of really interesting. And I guess that's informed, again, possibly from the commercial side of things as well.
Yeah, exactly. And they do bridge that gap. You know, there is that movement towards what I ended up doing, which was children's cartoons, which is really, that was really where I wanted to push things.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to get into the kids' cartoons and certainly get out of the commercials, which just was not, it wasn't doing it for me, you know. It was, commercials are commercials. They do what they're supposed to do, but, you know, they weren't necessarily making me feel good about what I was creating, put it that way.
Okay. Yeah. All right, okay. So that does make sense. Because I think when I was working on commercials, it was, it's very interesting because you're working in a different style every, like you were saying, every 3 months, but or 2 months or whatever it is. But then in terms of character, you can't sort of develop a character. It does take, I think, a series or a feature or something where you can actually sort of have a character and go, what would this character do in this situation and this kind of stuff, isn't it?
And the bottom line is that an ad is meant to sell products. That's what it does. And you know, and so what you become is a salesman. And that's great if you're, you know, if your aim is to be a salesman. That was not my aim. So,
Oh, that's definitely fair. Yeah. Cool. So then, I guess even in another way, talking about bridging the gap then, Managing the Universe then was...
Yeah.
Was that for teens? I'm not sure where that
is. Yes,
aired.
It was kind of for early teens.
Okay.
Teenage kids. And that was for RTE. That was initially, I think, a series of 31-minute episodes, and then they did another 30, so we ended up with 60 of those.
Excellent. And were they kind of inserts or something, or standalone things?
No, they were kind of standalone, standalone little mini show.
Yeah.
They're very short and very snappy. Yeah, they're very fast-paced. They were a lot of fun. It was a very creative process. We basically just got together and brainstormed ideas and just really made them as we went along. It was a fun show to make.
Yeah. Because that's dealing with actors again. Because Night Out is slightly rotoscoped.
That's right. Yeah, we shot Night Out completely live action first, and then drew over.
So again, and then in Managing the Universe, then that's, I guess you got the actors and you photographed them.
We photographed them. Yeah, different expressions.
You got libraries.
We basically made a library of all the characters. Now, we did end up shooting some stuff specifically for certain episodes.
Yes,
but for a large part, we just had this huge library of character heads.
Yes.
And, can't remember. Did we make the bodies from scratch? I can't remember. I honestly don't remember. But it was a very creative process and a very free process. Yeah. And I really enjoy some of those. Some of them are good fun.
Yeah, they are good. And I think in talks in terms of getting your sort of director's chops now, you've directed 60 of these things.
Exactly.
Now you kind of feel, okay, you know, now I'm a director of TV.
Yeah.
Episodic. I've got sort of more experience under my belt. So,
yes.
Is the next thing Rhubarb and Custard?
The next thing would have been Rhubarb.
How did that come about?
Yeah. That was the big move.
Yeah.
That's kind of where everything changed.
Yes, talk about your success and your expectations and your everything. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, this is where it kicks in, isn't it?
Yeah, Jared and Monster had been talking about Rhubarb for quite some time because the rights holders of Rhubarb wanted to make this new series. They wanted to make a second series of Rhubarb all these years later. And they were talking to different animation studios about how they would produce it. Now, for a large part, I kind of kept out of it in the early stages because I knew most of these deals are done on the economics.
Yes.
You know, they're really about, you know, can you replicate this look? What cost can you, will it, you know, is it to replicate that look? And then they'll go with the studio that's the cheapest.
Mm.
And so that's why, for me, you know, that was really in Jared's arena.
Yes.
And, but there was a time where we actually had to prove that we could give them what they wanted.
Yep.
And they gave us this Flash, or it was done in Flash, this animation sample that looked really different to the old Rhubarb and Custard. And I looked and I was like, that's not the Rhubarb and Custard I remember. Yeah. I don't recognize these characters. Now, it was quite nice. It was quite nice, but it wasn't the Rhubarb and Custard that I remember.
Mm.
And I thought I just felt that was kind of odd to revive these classic characters and make them so different. So I thought, yeah, we can do that. And we could do that. With what we were doing at the time in Flash, we had no problems replicating the look that they wanted. Yeah. But I thought, there's an opportunity here to do more, to do better. And I really loved the classic Rhubarb. I love the craziness of it. I love the spontaneity of it, which I think is often one of the hardest things to get in animation.
Yeah, absolutely. By its very nature. Yes, precisely, by definition. Yeah,
and I love spontaneity in animation, and it's a rare, rare thing. But the original Rhubarb had it. And so I looked at it and I thought, no, I want to see... I knew they wanted to use modern production methods of Flash, mostly from a cost perspective.
Yeah.
I looked at the old Rhubarb and I thought, let's see if we can get some of that old look with the modern production methods.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went away and I just did a test. I basically just did it myself. It was a very basic test to see if I could do that.
Right, yes. Okay,
yeah. And we sent it to the rights holders of Rhubarb. And suddenly everything changed. Because now it wasn't a case of them getting all these studios who could recreate the look equally, and then it would come down to cost. They now had us giving them something they hadn't quite asked for.
Aha, good, yeah.
And that made a big difference, because they looked at it and they were like, yeah, that's got the classic Rhubarb.
Mm.
And they loved it.
Mm.
And that's what they wanted. And so they came back to us and said, can you make that for a whole show? And we said, yes, of course.
That's the idea.
Not a problem. And the deals were done, and we got to produce 39 episodes of Rhubarb, and I got to direct it, and it was fantastic. It was just an amazing show to work on, and I got to work with Grange Calveley, who wrote all the stories. He's the original creator of Rhubarb, and he wrote all the stories back in 1974. I got to direct the late Richard Briers, which was fantastic. And I mean, when I say direct, I sat in a booth and nodded my head and told him that's excellent, because usually it was.
His voice is amazing, isn't it? Warm or something as well.
Yeah, there's a youthful enthusiasm. And, when I met him, he was in his 70s.
Right.
And he still, when he was in that booth, just the youthfulness in his voice was just amazing. He's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it was an amazing thing making that series. And again, very creative. We kept it spontaneous. And this was part of the big change with doing things in Flash is that... The entire crew for the production was in one room.
Mm.
And it's so easy to change things in Flash that we could animate a scene all the way till almost the very end and then decide, what if you did it this way? And what if we added this joke?
Mm-hmm.
And we could do that. Yeah. We had the freedom to do that, which was amazing. So we added layer upon layer of visual jokes to the show on top of what was already there in the scripts, and the scripts were great. So it was just really good fun. And... again, it was one of those moments in my career where at the start it was a massive struggle. Really keeping up with the production schedule, actually being in charge of the quality for a whole TV show, knowing where every scene is, where the animatics are, and the amount, the actual workload was incredible.
Hmm.
And so, yes, it was a struggle. But, once I survived it, I guess, what I picked up doing that was huge.
Excellent.
It was huge.
Oh. And how was it dealing with the rights owners? They were happy to let you... I presume they approved something, but...
Oh, they did. They got to see all the animatics and they got to see all the animation. Mm. But they were absolutely fantastic. And this was... Rhubarb worked on trust. And it really... There was this... It was this kind of chain of trust. There was the rights holders of Rhubarb and they trusted us to make a great show. And even the distributor as well, who were Celador at the time, they would keep involved in the process, but they very much trusted my instincts. And that trust was then passed down to the animators and to everyone who worked in the process. I knew the team so well and trusted each and every one of them to give me something great. And they did, it was it was this chain of trust, and it worked. It was such a great atmosphere as a result. There was nobody in that process at all whose job it was to make life difficult for others, which I've seen on other productions. You know, you see that, and I've heard so many stories, but everyone in that process made life easy for everyone else in the process.
Yeah, and that's a great situation to be in.
Yeah, it is, and by all accounts quite unusual, but it was great.
Yeah, it was lovely. Really good. And were you dealing with, were they like remaking the scripts, or was there new stories generated?
There were new stories. New stories. Grange Calverley had written 40 new stories. That's only 39 right. were made. There was one called When Something Evil Happened, and that was banned on the title alone. So I think it was Channel 5 didn't like the word evil.
Yeah.
So that pretty much ruled that episode out.
Yeah, well, I guess that's fair enough, I suppose.
So, yeah.
So, that sounds fantastic. So then is Fluffy Gardens?
Fluffy Gardens was next.
Excellent. Yeah. So now this is you creating now.
This was me creating.
And someone else's.
Yeah, and it was really Rhubarb that gave me the confidence to push ahead with Fluffy Gardens. Nice. Fluffy Gardens was not the first show I had tried to create, and it was not the first show that I tried to get off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, what Rhubarb did was get me over the fears. It got me over the fears of failure,
mm-hmm.
and it got me over the fears of success, which we were kind of talking about earlier. Yes, you know, I knew I could handle the workload, and I knew it wasn't going to be overwhelming to the point that I couldn't do it. You know, I knew I could stand up to that pressure. And mm-hmm. so I got to a point where I welcomed it. You know, it's like, yeah, give it to me. I will take it, and I will still make a good show. So making Rhubarb, by the time I was close to the end of that production, I knew, I'm ready to make my own show.
Excellent.
I'm ready to create the characters. I'm ready to help tailor the show. Now, what I didn't expect to be ready for, and certainly didn't feel ready for, was writing the show,
which was
a whole other thing.
Mm.
But I knew I could make a show, and I knew I could make a good show, and I wanted to make a show for preschool kids. And I wanted to make a safe, gentle show, because this was kind of at the height of the Teletubbies.
Right.
And TV, children's TV was getting crazier and crazier. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, no, there's room for something gentle.
Yes.
There's room for something that's got those just calm stories that are built on positivity. And that's really what I wanted. So,
Because that's the thing you really get from watching it. You just sort of say, it's almost like a gentle breeze or something. It's like it's really kind of almost relaxing instead of watching it.
And that's what I wanted. I wanted to be this oasis in this crazy world of children's television.
That's exactly what it is, actually. It turned out. So you had the ideas sort of for a long time before you even started on Rhubarb and other things, or was it sort of fresh slate and right, I'm going to come up with this thing once you had finished with?
No, I had characters doodled that I didn't know what I was going to do with.
Okay.
They were just they began life just as doodles,
right?
And they were very crude doodles. What had happened was I realized my drawing was becoming a handicap. It's one of those things, we pick up so many bad drawing habits mostly in our teenage years, and I found that the more I drew, the more I would revert back to those really old habits.
Right.
And so I wanted to break myself out of habits, and I started drawing with a mouse.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you were saying this on your... Jason has this amazing blog, by the way. You should go look at it.
Oh,
but there's lots of good stuff about it. So you... Which is amazing, yeah.
I started drawing with a mouse because I knew there was simply no way that I could draw with a mouse and use my old habits.
Yes, exactly.
And fall back
into
old habits. It was going to force me to do things differently.
Yes.
And I ended up with these very crude-looking characters. Mm-hmm. And then I took those, and I had the idea of creating a children's show was almost separate to those, but I then brought them together. And that became Fluffy Gardens, and I slightly refined the characters so they weren't quite as crude, but I still kept the crude beginnings of them, and their weird lopsided eyes and little fingers that are really just like clouds. And which is kind of funny, because those little touches sometimes have kind of become my signature style, and yet they came from drawing with a mouse and simply not being able to draw any other way. So I put them together, and I ended up with maybe 10 characters at the beginning and a few story ideas and just a few early pitch images, and that became the show. That's what got it off the ground, really.
Because another thing that you mentioned in one of those posts anyway, is talking about the sort of visual simplicity. We're going to start talking about preschool now, we'll never end, because we're both,
fans
of preschool. This sort of visual simplicity for children, which I found really interesting.
I'm a big believer in visual simplicity for kids, and Fluffy Gardens had that, and it had this kind of crude feel that I think went, I think there are a couple of things going on in a child's head when they see drawings, and partly they're seeing what they can draw, mm-hmm. and they see what they aspire to draw.
Yeah.
And sometimes what they draw, they see as actually what they aspire to draw. You know, they perceive it as different in their own heads. And with Fluffy Gardens, I almost wanted to give children characters that they would know they could draw.
Yeah.
That they would be able to actually sit down with a crayon and just in a few lines be able to draw those characters.
Yeah.
And in that was my way of very early on, even before I jumped into the depths of preschool, that was my thinking and my way of, I think, helping children relate to these characters was trying to bridge the gap between what they could actually draw and what they see on TV.
I think so, because it's the same with, I think that's part of the reason why Peppa, I worked on Peppa Pig, and that's, I think, part of its appeal as well. And you can even see and I'm fairly sure this probably happens with some of your work as well, that the same creators had made a new show, Ben and Holly.
That's right,
and I'm sort of talking to parents, and their little 2-year-olds see Ben and Holly, and they go, Peppa!
Yes.
Because it's sort of, the colours are the same, and the shapes, and it's that sort of simplicity.
Yeah.
And it just reads, and they're sort of like magnetised by the screen or
they
something.
Are.
Whereas
and
I think if there's too much
and it's
going
so,
on, it puts them off or something.
Exactly. Well, it's so absolutely clear. You know, if you look at Peppa Pig or Ben and Holly, every frame is crystal clear. Like, kids in no way will misinterpret what they're seeing.
Yeah.
And I think that's not true for a lot of TV shows.
Yeah.
I think there's a danger in a huge amount of TV shows in the preschool area that children will actually misinterpret what they're seeing, because they're processing visual information differently.
Yeah.
Whereas Peppa is blindingly clear, and that's wonderful for kids, because kids are then, they're following the story, they're following the characters, they're not wasting any time trying to process visual information.
Completely sort of engaged and not distracted.
Yeah,
like
they're not, they're not looking at a detail that they're not supposed to be looking at. They're just focusing on those characters, and they can read them so well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, Peppa Pig is up there as one of the pinnacles of design for preschool kids, as far as I'm concerned. I think it's just, it's an amazingly well-designed show. Mm-hmm. And it in no way surprises me that it was such a huge hit for kids.
Yeah.
I think it's so good on so many levels.
I think it's a
wonderful show.
It is, it's great. And I think that, yeah, Fluffy Gardens has a bit of that clarity.
Yeah.
Cosmo as well, I think.
Cosmo got a bit fancier.
Yeah.
And it had to... Cosmo had an extra aim to juggle, which was getting across the amazing qualities of space. And isn't it visually fantastic? And there was... I spent a huge amount of time working that balance.
Because
with Planet Cosmo... Part of the aim was showing space is amazing, you know, and we do that for adults. Mm-hmm. We do that by showing them these amazingly detailed pictures of Saturn with all the rings and lens flare, or these nebulas of all different pretty colors.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't translate to children, to preschool.
Yes.
It doesn't translate, because kids won't have a clue what they're seeing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And yet, if you got it down to just the most basic preschool, if I Fluffy Gardens did, for example, then it loses all the majesty.
Well, this is exactly,
It loses that amazing feel.
The awe factor.
So I had this incredibly difficult balancing act to still capture some of the amazing things about space, but do so in a way that preschool kids, and even the younger end of preschool kids, can read.
Yes.
So that was quite a challenge.
Yeah, I think you've managed it. I think it's a really nice balance watching sort of some of the episodes. Yeah, I think it's sort of, there is this sort of magical, like you say, wonder of space kind of thing. But it is all very readable and clear and, you know.
Yeah, the outlines became very important. The clarity of the characters became very, very important. And, you know, even on a scene-by-scene basis, there was a lot, you know, I just had to weigh up every shot and go, will kids actually know what they're looking at here? And have I given them enough context for each thing? Because it also, the other thing with Planet Cosmo is that for a large part, a huge amount of these things that young children are being shown, it's going to be the first time they ever see these things. Mm, yeah, so they don't already have a context. You know, if I show them, if I show them a washing machine, you know, most young children at that stage in their lives will have seen a washing machine. So they can already just process that as, ah, that's a washing machine. Yeah. They can file that away. If they see Jupiter's big red spot, that's a whole other thing. They don't have a file for that yet.
Yes.
So, that was a tricky process. It was a tricky process, and it was a real balancing act.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll probably talk a bit more about Planet Cosmo further on, but just talking about then as we are preschool, and then you were saying that, so that's the visual side. So yes. You were saying you began writing for Fluffy Gardens, and you hadn't written much before? Or
I used to write when I was very young and write short stories and stuff, but never professionally.
Mm.
And with Fluffy Gardens, I did not intend to write that show.
Okay.
I thought we would do what other shows do, which is
get
a team of writers. Yeah. You know, if you want good writing, you hire writers.
Yeah.
that's how you do it. My producer, Jared, said, well, why don't you write them? And I was like, well, because I'm not a writer. And he said, yeah, but you've told me the stories and they're, you know the stories. And so it's going to be hard for somebody else to capture the soul of what you've got in your head. And, and I thought, well, that's true. So then I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll write a couple of stories to set the tone, basically. And so I wrote the very first story, which was Paola the Cat, and the second story I wrote, I think, was Floella the Fruit Bat. And I may have written one other. And so they were just kind of spec scripts just to show people what the show would be like.
Right.
Again, even at that point, I didn't intend to write it. And my feeling was always that we would get good writers to make my stinky stories better. And then we pitched at the Cartoon Forum, and what we did, which was kind of unusual, is we went ahead and made the whole Paola the Cat story. We made the entire episode and pitched that episode.
That is unusual, because usually at that Cartoon Forum is a market, and you usually just present it like a little trailer.
That's right, And we've done it that way on other occasions, but with Fluffy Gardens, I guess I just felt that the more information I could give people, the better, because...
Yeah.
People would either like it or they would dislike it. And there was no point in stringing people along who it would turn out didn't like it in the end.
That makes sense.
You know,
yes,
so
yes,
I thought, if we show them a whole episode, people can decide, yes, I like it or they don't like it. You know, and so it makes things nice and simple. And that is actually what happened. It worked very well from that perspective, because some broadcasters instantly declared themselves out, which was great, because you're not going for months hoping that they're gonna come back, whereas other broadcasters were so enthusiastic and absolutely loved the show, and there was never a chance that they were going to come back at another point and go, well, we've seen a bit more of it and now we're not so happy with it, we're not so sure, because now they saw the whole show.
This is what you get.
This is what they get. They knew what they were getting, so that enthusiasm was always going to carry through the whole project, which was great. That was fantastic. But people loved the story, and people seemed to love the writing, which was fantastic. In fact, the two Peppa Pig guys, Neville and Mark were at the Cartoon Forum presentation.
Excellent.
And they came up to me at the very end. And when you're doing this, it's a 40-minute pitch at the Cartoon Forum.
Oh, wow, okay.
And it is a nerve-wracking experience. You're basically putting your show out there to international broadcasters, distributors. So I was absolutely terrified. I was hyped up on adrenaline. And just by the end of this pitch, I was shaking.
Yeah,
I barely knew where I was. And so these two guys come up to me at the end and go, that was really good. We really loved that show. It looked really nice. And I'm like, I'm just kind of shaking, go, thank you. And they walk a few feet away from me and then turn around and go, we're the Peppa Pig guys, by the way.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what? as they walked off. And then it was only about 10 minutes later, I was sitting there going, that was the Peppa Pig guys. Oh, my God. And so that meant a huge amount
to me. I was going
to
say,
it really did.
Sort of a seal of approval.
Yeah. Oh, that really meant a lot to me. And it was one of those things that the more time that went on, the more it meant, if you know what I mean, the more I kind of processed, wow, you know, if to get the seal of approval from anyone, you know, to get it from those guys was just amazing.
Yeah, because I know from personal experience, if they don't like something, they'll tell you as well.
Right. Well, this was the thing. They took the time to actually come up to me and say that, which was great. But yeah, the reaction to the stories was wonderful. And so then the question came up, could you write all the episodes?
Right.
And that was so not what I originally planned, but the more I thought about it, the more it made sense to me. You know, I knew these characters, I knew the world, and I knew the soul of what I wanted in the show. But more than that, what I'd found from writing those early stories was that there actually was a language style.
Okay, yes.
Because it was a narrator-driven show.
That's right,
and it was kind of written like storybooks. I didn't when I originally came up with it, I wanted them to effectively be storybooks. And so they were written like that. And so the actual language style became very important to the show. It's kind of a character in itself in the show, is the language style. So then at that point, it started to make sense to me to write the whole show. Yeah. And I wrote 40 episodes, and there was a massive learning curve. And again, it's the same with the directing and the animating early on in my career. I struggled.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things in those early stories I'd look at now and go, no, that's a bit stinky. But I had a great script editor who rescued the worst parts of my stories. Hilary Baverstock, she was just fantastic. And she taught me a huge amount about writing. And the more I wrote, the better I got. And what really helped then was because I wrote 40 episodes for series one, and we were producing it while I was writing it, which workload, directing, because the workload of directing, directing plus writing. Basically, what I would have to do is I'd vanish for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And I would just disappear off, write a whole bunch more stories, and then come back and catch up. And it was very tough from a workload perspective.
Yeah.
And it also did, what it didn't allow me to do was constantly reevaluate what I was doing, which kind of worked for the show anyway, because it was just this constant rolling. It was like a moving train at that point, it just had to keep going.
Yep.
But what was fantastic was once we made those episodes, months later, being able to get the reaction from parents and the reactions from kids and what characters worked really well for them and what didn't work as well. And then for me to be able to watch those stories myself with a bit of distance.
Yes.
And that being able to reevaluate it at that stage taught me a huge amount more about writing. And not just writing, but being able to write for the screen.
Mm.
Because I was the one who had to direct these episodes, which was fantastic in some ways.
Yeah.
Because I knew I wasn't going to write something in that I couldn't make happen.
Yeah.
I was never going to scupper the animation process,
Yeah, yeah.
So I was always, the two always went hand in hand.
That's
for
good.
Me.
Yeah, that's a nice way, because I know, I think some writers are a little bit like, right, writing brain time, kick off the animation brain, do this, and then turn off the writing brain, turn off the animation brain. It's like, oh, I have to do all this now.
Yes, exactly.
But it's great if you can have the two in your head at the same time.
Yeah, no, I'll always work them the same, together. And so when writing, I'm very much thinking about the end product, what it will look like on screen, how it will be paced on screen.
Mm-hmm.
How it will have to be produced. But I'm also doing that when I'm directing or script editing on other shows or at any part of the process, really, I'm thinking about the storytelling, I'm thinking about the characters. So they're all one.
Yes.
And they all lead towards that one end result.
Yeah.
So they have to come together and they have to work. So at no point do I ever want those processes to be at odds with each
other. Yes,
it's actually a wonderful bonus to be able to write the stories that you're going to direct.
Absolutely.
It's really good to be able to do that.
That's great. And then, so then
I was a children's writer.
Yeah.
On top of everything else.
Everything else, fantastic. Yeah, it's great. And so is Ballybraddon the next thing? Or is it Punky?
I think it was Ballybraddon was the next thing.
Right.
So that was
I hadn't seen much of that, and then I was looking at some, and I didn't really. I kind of. It's a drama. It's like a.
It's an animated drama series, which is very
that's
very
brave,
interesting.
Man. Like that's
that's the thing I love about Ballybraddon, and Ballybraddon is it's aimed kind of 7 to 10s ish, which is kind of outside my what is now my special area yes. of expertise, which is preschool.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a whole different show, and it was originated here in Geronimo at Monster Animation at the time. It was mm-hmm. Gerard, the producer, came up with the initial concept of making this series about kids playing hurling. And
yes.
it was just, I'm not a sports person, and hurling does nothing for me. I've no interest in it. But Ballybraddon is a lot more than the hurling, because it's about these characters.
Yes.
And it's kind of like as you say, it's an animated drama about yeah. these characters. And the hurling is really what brought the characters together. But that's
yes.
not the root of the show for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into this idea that of a continuing story.
That's right, because it's continuing at the end.
It's a continuing story.
And cliffhanger endings. And
that's
stuff.
Right,
yeah,
it's cliffhanger endings. And building up towards this end championship final, and actually having an end, you know. So it's got this big story arc across
yes.
20 episodes, and we gave it to a writer called Noel McGee to develop up, and it was just bare bones in the early stages. And Noel took it and came back with this absolutely giant document of this town, everybody who lived there,
oh, wow.
the history going back 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
Every detail. Noel just ran with it, and he created something that was really exciting, and it was like this living, breathing place. And at that point, I knew, yeah, we can do something really good with this, and
mm-hmm.
do something really interesting. And there's so few continuing storylines on children's TV.
Yes,
and as you say, to make an animated drama was very brave, and also to do one based on such an Irish.
Yes.
thing, you know, and these are Irish kids, and they talk like Irish kids.
Yeah.
We really embraced that, and I felt this was something that couldn't be made anywhere else, and it just
That's
couldn't
true.
Exist anywhere else, and we were going to end up with something really unique. And it was challenging from an animation perspective, because they were a lot more realistic than the preschool characters, and it was quite a tough production. But by the end of it, you know, that's something I've become very proud of, because it's very different. It's just something that just exists on its own.
Yeah,
and
it is different. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah, and it's been interesting showing it to my kids now. Actually, because RT Junior launched a while back, and they were showing Ballybraddon from the start.
Okay,
and so my daughters watched it, and Daisy would be six,
okay.
and she was kind of at the perfect age. She really got into it and really loved the idea of a continuing story. In fact, she hadn't really seen that before, and it kind of blew her mind, you know, that it would continue on. And she loved that. She really got invested in the characters. But it was funny seeing Alice. There's nothing in it that's inappropriate for four-year-olds, but it's not aimed at four-year-olds.
Yes.
You know, it's just not aimed at that audience. And Alice seeing stories with cliffhangers at the end and these continuing storylines, I asked her one day, Alice, are you actually enjoying Ballybraddon?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yes, Daddy, I really like it, but I'd love you to make a full one someday. And so in her mind, because they didn't have this complete wrapped up ending, they weren't finished episodes,
yeah.
you know, so it was this perception. She just didn't get the continuing storyline. But Daisy loved it. She really got into it. And, you know, then I think of other shows, like Pokemon has a continuing storyline.
Yeah.
Kids love it. It's that idea of the story carrying on and meeting characters that will then come back.
And what happens to them. And
I think there's something kind of exciting about that for kids.
Definitely. And then there's something I did want to just ask you about,
yeah.
which I don't know how interesting this is to everyone else, but for me, there was something on your blog you written about, and I don't know if it was, I think it was Ballybraddon you were talking about, where the first episode you weren't happy with it, so you guys just sort of canned it or something. Is that right? Or no?
I shouldn't say it out loud, but I've done that a couple of times.
How do you, from a production point of view, how does that work? That's amazing. I mean, that's amazing. Don't get me wrong. And I'm kind of, I think it's great if it's not.
Yeah, from a production point of view, basically I like to build in quite a bit of pre-production time for a start, but also I guess a certain amount of contingency time.
All right.
And the reason being that you can make things better.
Yes.
You know, you may find things when you're making episode 3
mm-hmm.
or episode 4 that you wish you had done in episode 1.
That
happens a lot. And I've seen it a lot on shows where you can look at the early episodes and you know they're the early episodes.
Yes, because they're still finding their feet.
Feet. Yeah. And so what happened with Ballybraddon was we animated... we animated the first episode, and the first episode looked good. There was actually nothing wrong with the animation.
Right.
But by the time all the stories were written and we had this continuing storyline, we actually, what happened was that the Noel's writing was just excellent. And, and he built this great story arc. And by the time we got to the end, we all realized that the first episode didn't quite do it justice in setting up that story strong enough.
Yeah, okay.
You know, this, in a way, it didn't tell people just how good the story is going to get. And so what we did was, Noel, we didn't scrap the whole episode.
So was it a rewrite of the script or not?
Yeah, it was a rewrite of the script. Okay. So Noel went away and said, well, let's see if I can rewrite some of the script. And he rewrote about half the story.
Okay.
And we re-recorded it, which was a bit of a nightmare because a couple of the cast members, their voices had broken.
I'd be surprised if they hadn't.
But we re-recorded it and we reanimated about half the episode. And it was so worth doing.
Yeah.
It was a better series for it.
Yeah.
And I think the first episode was much stronger as a result. And I think it meant that when kids first saw that first episode, they really knew what they were getting into. And, and I think that did the rest of the show a favor because it meant it was far more likely that they were going to continue to watch.
I agree with you because it's the same on the guys from Peppa make changes right till the end, and that's how you get a good thing. The Simpsons do it. The Simpsons, and they're drawn animation, they still make insert gags at the sort of 11th hour and stuff, and it drives everyone crazy, and it drives me crazy at times. But actually, you know, if the end product is better because of it, then no one's gonna know watching it.
Well, this is the thing for me, the quality is everything, you know. And I think, and when you're directing a show or when you're producing a show, you know, when you're writing a show, you have a huge responsibility to make that as good as you can possibly make it.
Yeah.
And that goes all the way down the line, you know, and it's down to animators just starting out. Their own level of internal quality control is a massive factor. It's like when people do tests. It's, you know, when people do animation tests, for a large part, what I am testing, what I'm gauging when people send me an animation test is actually at what point did they choose to send me that test? You know, at what point did their internal quality control say, yes, this is okay for them to see?
Yeah.
And that's a big indicator. But when it comes to making shows, for me, I want the audience to get the absolute best that I can give them.
Yes.
And so if it does turn out that I make an episode and I know it could have been a better episode, then I don't want to just let it go. I want to actually go back and let's make that a better episode.
Yeah.
Let's improve it, you know. And there are ways, you know, depending on how the production runs, there are ways usually of making that work. And, you know, you can shuffle certain other things. There's always economies of scale. And you know the way with productions that early on episodes can take a long time.
Yes.
Whereas episodes at the end of production can go a lot quicker. So you can kind of project that and know, okay, I can afford to redo this amount because I know I'm going to end up with extra time towards the end, you know? Yeah. And so that's the way I do it. The other thing I don't like doing is missing deadlines. So it's not at the expense of the show.
Yes,
you know,
okay.
Not
at
the expense of the production. Right. You can't go in and just scupper a production and go, no, I'm not letting that episode go out.
Yeah.
So you've got to make it work for the production as a whole. But I think, you've got to give kids the absolute best. And So if something's not working, make it better. So that's what I try and do.
Excellent. I couldn't agree with you more. So then it's Punky. So what was your role exactly on Punky? So
I'm creative director on Punky. It's a kind of vague role. I was a big part of the development of Punky, and I script edit the show.
Okay.
And, you know, I check all the animatics in and out. You know, it's kind of like series director, but I don't call myself series director because I think the actual director of the show, Simon Crane, just does so much of that himself and has taken so much ownership of it and does such a great job that I actually, you know, it wouldn't be right for me to call myself series director. He's the series director, you know? So I guess I'm kind of, in a way, I'm kind of his safety net when he needs me in a lot of ways, you know? So I just basically oversee things. I guess quality control in a way is part of the job. Yeah. So I just, I'm kind of across all the areas, but.
Because I think, like you say about developing it, I think it's, I think it works. It could have gone sort of a horrible way. You know, it's sort of a fine line to
well,
to
I was tread. Very, I've got to be honest, I was very, very nervous about
it. Because the idea is that the protagonist, the girl, is a girl who just happens to have...
She has Down syndrome. And when the concept came to us, I was actually very reluctant to take it on, which I'm usually very positive about things and you know, I get in strongly positively, but I... With Punky, what we had was a main character with Down syndrome, and now in the initial project that came into us was different in that it was aimed at older children.
Okay.
And I felt that Punky herself as a character didn't quite fit with the older kids. But the main issue for me was that a cartoon by its nature is a caricature.
Yes.
And yes. You know, yeah. how were we going to translate Punky in a way that wasn't just a caricature of people with Down syndrome, and I just thought that was a minefield, and so easy to get wrong. And I did not want to be someone who was the person who was making fun of people with Down syndrome.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I didn't want to do that. So I've got to say, I was actually very reluctant about the project very early on. Gerard in here really championed that project, and it's to his credit. You know, he saw the potential. Mm-hmm. And he knew we could overcome the difficulties.
Yeah.
And Lindsay Sedgwick, who created the show, also, you know, she was very passionate about it. And so Gerard pushed hard to make this show, and I kind of had, I thought, okay, well, let's see what I can do. You know, can we actually develop this in a way that's going to work? And the design took a huge amount of work for exactly that reason. You know, we wanted to avoid the pitfalls. For a start, we couldn't ignore the fact that Punky had Down syndrome. Yeah. You know, it's part, it's one of many things about her.
Yes.
So it's important to the show.
Yeah.
So it's not like we could just whitewash over the show and pretend that it's not there.
Yeah.
But you know, there's then a line where it just becomes caricature, and we wanted to avoid that. So that was a lot of work. And then in terms of the writing, I wanted to pull it into preschool because for me it felt... Punky felt like a preschool character in the very early documents, and it felt like she just wasn't existing in a preschool show.
Okay.
So I wanted to pull the whole show to preschool because I felt it would just work at that on a preschool level. And I also thought it would be very good for preschool children because almost before they are even familiar, you know, some children will have encountered many people with Down syndrome, some children won't, but a lot of children will only... just, you know, children's lives are very small, so they'll only just be in their home environment, really. And I thought it would be very good to normalize a character with Down syndrome, even before kids are kind of out there in the world meeting other kids.
Definitely.
So for me, it
makes sense.
Once I kind of thought, okay, we can get past the difficulties, I thought, it makes sense to have it as a preschool show. It can do some real good.
Yeah, suddenly it's an opportunity.
Exactly, it's an opportunity. Yeah. And that's, I guess that's at the point... really when it became a preschool show, that's kind of at the point I started to think, we can do something really good. And as you say, it became an opportunity, and my reluctance completely left me, and it became a much more positive experience. And we got Andrew Brenner, who created Humph and does so much wonderful writing. We got him to write the stories because he's a real... Andrew's writing in preschool is fantastic because he writes for very young children with a real honesty. He doesn't do those sugary sweet stories that pretend there's no real world going on. He writes the real world stuff in there, but does it in the way that children perceive it.
Accessible,
which is fantastic. And so because Punky needed that honesty, Andrew was the perfect choice for writing, and he really did an incredible job at making that show what it is.
No, it's great.
So it was a long development process, and there were difficult parts, but it got there in the end. And when we got it right, we kind of all knew.
Yep.
You know, we knew once it started coming together, it was like, that's actually working. And we consulted a lot with Down Syndrome Ireland and with parents to make sure that it was something that they felt would work for them. And the reaction was really positive. And so it seems to have done its job. And we're now making 20 new episodes of Punky at the moment.
Fantastic.
It's a very popular show.
Yeah, it's great. So then Cosmo then is your your latest.
Cosmos, my latest. Yeah, Cosmos, in between those, we yeah. made another series of Fluffy Gardens and a Christmas special. But yeah, then on to Cosmo. So, yeah, Planet Cosmo started development while we were doing Punky.
Okay.
And because I was not writing Punky and I wasn't directing Punky, that gave
all this free time.
Exactly, all this free time. You know, I was so used to writing and directing shows together. It's like suddenly what was I going to do? So I wanted to use that time for development.
Yes.
And at this point, between series one of Fluffy Gardens and really between series one and series two of Fluffy Gardens, I really realized my passion for preschool shows.
Okay.
And not just passion, but what I saw was the amount of research that I could do and actually what I could learn. Really, I in the early episodes of Fluffy Gardens, I kind of stumbled my way blindly through them, and it's a miracle some of the early episodes turned out to be good. And you know, so many people do that, and now I'm a complete advocate of doing the opposite, which is actually do your homework, because there is homework there.
Yes.
You know, the research is there.
Yep.
And so between series one and series two of Fluffy Gardens, I immersed myself in preschool.
Okay.
And I watched every preschool show I could find.
Mm-hmm.
I studied them, I broke them down, I talked to kids to find out what they liked, what they didn't like.
Right.
I talked to parents to find out what they were watching, what their kids were watching, and what they weren't watching, what they were talking about. And then I started digging into the US academic research, because there's a huge amount of that.
Right,
you know, really, since Sesame Street, there was research before Sesame Street, but since Sesame Street in the late 60s,
mm-hmm.
in the US, they have been researching preschool content in depth. You know, they've been researching the good that you can do with TV, the bad that TV can do, you know, the negative effects, and then down to individual parts of that, you know, how relevant is music to education and preschool stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they go into real details, and it was like a gold mine going through that research, and I was looking at it going, why is everyone else not looking at this? You know?
This is your secret stash.
Exactly. Yeah. I know they use it in the US a lot.
Blues Clues is quite...
Oh, Blues like Clues, absolutely. Well, the amount of research that went into Blues Clues is incredible. You know, they've academics studying that show, and they test every episode, and they break it down to individual parts, and that, for a large part, was why it was so successful.
Yeah.
They did it so well, but over this end of the Atlantic, we don't hugely go in for that stuff. And I just started uncovering these, and as you say, it was like finding this secret stash. It was like I'd found this treasure, and so I built up this massive wealth of knowledge, and with the amount of study that I had done, I knew so many different ways that I could create a show,
mm-hmm.
and so many different things that I couldn't apply to Fluffy Gardens series two, because that show had been defined
precisely by
series one. I couldn't just reinvent the show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But when it came to creating a new show, I knew I'm going to give kids something really, really good for them. Something that entertains them first and foremost, mm-hmm. you know, makes them laugh, makes them smile, makes them want to watch more episodes, has them jumping off the couch and talking to the characters and stuff like that. I wanted all of that entertainment and the joy of those shows, and through that I wanted to give them something really good, something positive, something educational. And it kind of came down to dinosaurs or space. it's going to be dinosaurs or space. Dinosaurs or space. And there's a few shows out there about dinosaurs, and I could not for the life of me find something good about space.
Okay, great.
So I thought it's got to be space, because even for my own daughters, I have two young daughters, and my youngest was, she was probably only 2.5 or 3 when I was starting to develop Planet Cosmo early on, and she was just getting interested in space. And I couldn't find anything for her.
Right.
I couldn't find anything even in books. There's great books for like kids that are 6-year-olds or 8-year-olds who are already interested in space.
Yes.
But what I couldn't find was something that was really good to introduce young kids to space.
Yeah.
And that's what I set out to create. I set out to create a show that would introduce children to the solar system and the planets that are around us. Because this is one of the things that I just love about space. And it's so huge for kids, I think, is that there are you know, we show them all these fantasy worlds in kid shows, and you know, here's a unicorn kingdom and here's a fairy land.
Yep.
But here are these whole other worlds, and they're real.
Yes, that's amazing.
They're real. You know, these aren't just made up things. Yep. These are actually real. And so my big goal with Planet Cosmo initially was to introduce kids to these planets and let them walk away knowing that these are actually real.
Yes.
You know, this is real stuff. This is not just made up.
Yeah. And is that why you have the live action, or is that
That's exactly why he's there. Because, and this came out of the research, you know, because one of the things that really struck me was that so little preschool content, even the educational stuff, makes clear what's real and what's not real.
Yes.
For example, Dora the Explorer teaches real Spanish language, mm-hmm. but does so in a world with trolls and unicorns and other things. And it's like, well, how are kids actually supposed to know that that's a real language?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, why couldn't that be just some fairy made-up language?
Yeah, yeah.
You
know, that's a fair question.
You know, Dora never says, "Listen, kids, the unicorn stuff, that's bullshit." But the language stuff is real, and that's exactly what we wanted to do with The Astronomer. I thought at some point in this show we actually have to tell kids, look, whatever about the rest of the stuff in the show, the stuff that you're learning about the planet,
the stuff that I'm
saying, is actually real. Yeah. This exists. And I thought that needed the weight of an actual human being.
Yeah.
You know, they can enjoy the cartoon, but this human being comes in and goes, "Listen, kids, this stuff is real."
Yeah. No, I think that's great. I think that works really well, because it even struck me, you know, sort of watching this, going, "Oh, he's got a, why has he got a live action?" And then realize what his purpose is.
Exactly. And he's a real astronomer. He's an astrophysicist. So he's a real guy. He knows his stuff.
Cool.
So that was the aim of the show, and it was a long development process. It started while we were making Punky, and it went through a lot of different forms. Mm-hmm. Because in a way, I mean, it goes back to what we were saying about making the best. I wanted Planet Cosmo to take everything that I'd learned to that point and make the absolute best show that I could possibly make.
Yeah.
I mean, my aim, I kept saying to people, I wanted it to be the third best children's show ever made.
Okay.
And people, of course, would always ask me, what's the first and second? And I would say that the second best children's show ever made is Sesame Street.
Yeah.
And the first, the best children's show ever, that's yet to be created, because I want to give myself something to strive for after this, you know? So that's going to be my next show.
Okay.
Yeah. So I knew,
working your way up to the
exactly,
charts.
Working my way up to that. So I knew, you know, could I beat Sesame Street? No. But I could make a better show than a hell of a lot of children's shows out there.
Yeah.
And that was my aim, you know? Great. So I wanted to make this show the absolute peak of my experience and my abilities to that point.
Well, I think you can definitely see the sort of a progression and a sort of, the high point seems like you've sort of been building up to it, sort of thing.
Yeah.
It looks great. Like, it's
thank you.
And I think it works really well. So it is.
It's certainly done its job. You know, I've seen... I mean, for starters, it has entertained kids, and kids seem to find it very funny, which is great, you know, because I used a huge amount of the research, like I was saying, from the US shows, mm-hmm. but the US shows don't often go in for comedy in the same way that we do over here. Like, the UK shows are quite often, like, Peppa is hilarious.
Yes, it is, yeah.
In a way that most US shows aren't.
That's right. I mean, because we used to do screenings, and you could have, you have a bunch of... sort of 20 to 50 year olds sitting around laughing at Peppa as well, you know?
Exactly. Whereas the US shows are fantastic at engaging kids, and they are fantastic at the educational stuff. They're amazing at, they know their stuff when it comes to actually educating children. They really know their stuff. So I wanted to take the two.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to, like I said, entertain first, which goes back to Sesame Street, really, which was their ethos. I think they said, you've got to get kids into church before you can preach to them, you know, that's kind of the thing, you know, it's you've got to entertain the kids. And kids seem to find the show very funny, and they adore the songs.
Yes.
And they love the songs. And the songs have all the planet information.
Yep.
And I've seen, like, parents have sent me emails of just how much it's got their kids into space, and they've been making mobiles of the planets and stuff like that. So it's really working. It's getting kids excited about space.
Yeah.
And it's teaching them about space. You know, they're telling kids, or they're telling their parents about things that they found out on TV.
Yeah.
And that was really valuable. And that was another thing that came out of research really into kids' TV, is what I found with preschool kids is that it's kind of harder for shows to take off, because if we're talking about a show that we like, adults will talk about shows.
Yes.
You know, I watch Mad Men. I'll say, did you see the latest episode of Mad Men? And you'll go, no, I didn't see it. And I go, you should totally check that out.
Yeah.
And we spread knowledge of shows in that way. Or we do it on the internet. And suddenly you're talking to millions of people, telling them about the show that you watched. And a good show can spread so quickly. Young preschool kids don't really talk to other preschool kids about what they watched on TV.
Yeah.
They'll, like, wear a Batman t-shirt or whatever when they're at school age, and things can spread that way. But I found they very rarely just sit down with another kid and go, did you see that episode of Dora with the giant talking mountain? You know, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. So this was a challenge. I thought, well, I could make this great show, and parents as well. Parents, quite often, a lot of parents aren't fully aware of what their kids are watching. You know, some parents are very, make it their business to be very aware. A lot of times they're not. Whereas what I found was kids love to spread information, but only if it's real. Like, I mean, they're not going to come to you and go, you know, did you know Pikachu has this electric type? Well, actually, kids might.
But
very young kids won't do that to their parents.
Yeah.
Whereas if they find this interesting fact, like, you know, did you know that planet Earth can fit inside Jupiter's big red spot 3 times?
Yeah.
And they know that that's real, they'll tell everybody.
Yeah. And yes, just come out with it.
They'll love showing, you know, when they have knowledge, they love showing that they have that knowledge. It makes them feel smart, and they love showing off that knowledge. And where that has value for the kids, for me, like, I mean, other people probably exploit that for branding and stuff like that, but where it had real value for me is that it would let the parents know that there's this interest in space.
Yes.
And so if I could create a show that kids would talk about, then parents could then go and feed that interest. You know, they'll show them videos of the International Space Station or whatever and start to feed that interest. And that's exactly what's happened.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. You know, it's done what it was set out to do.
Well, there you can't ask for much more than that.
Great. And it was a huge amount of fun to make, and it's peppered with little classic sci-fi references, and
we're all
kind of sci-fi fans. And, we dropped quite a few in there for the parents, you know, and again, that's one of the strengths of some of the really good shows, I think, is that parents enjoy watching.
Yes, they can be watchable for parents. Yeah,
you know, they're not agree with parents 100%. Aren't sitting there wanting to tear their eyeballs.
Yes.
Out, you know? So yeah, Planet Cosmo was developed a lot of the time with parents as well in mind, that they will be watching it with their kids.
Yeah. Wonderful. Fantastic. So I suppose the only thing left to talk about now is, and I don't know how much you do or don't want to talk about, is after 18 years with Monster or Geronimo, as they're now called, you are going out on your own. You're going to do something else.
I am. I'm finishing up, and off to explore new adventures.
Very good.
Seek out new life and new civilizations. it's a huge move for me. I've been creative director here for 13 years.
Okay.
And you know, I took it from being that studio that was making commercials and a very small studio to a studio that now has something like 25 hours of children's programming behind it, successful shows, shows that have spread internationally, you know, and we've become very well known for the type of shows that we make, which is fantastic. So it just seemed like the right time. Okay. It seemed like the right time to discover new challenges. And really with Planet Cosmo, like I was saying, I wanted that show to be the pinnacle of everything that I had learned up to that point about making TV shows and especially about communicating with preschool kids.
Mm.
And so in a way, with that, once I had completed that, I kind of felt like I had this huge mission that I'd been leading up to for probably my whole career.
Right,
you know, I didn't always know that was where it was going.
Yeah.
But when I got there, I knew this is what it's all been leading up to, this show. And when I finished it, it was like, yes, okay, I've now done that. My mission is complete. And now it's time to look for a new framework, a new way of doing things, a new way of taking those skills and offering them to children in different ways.
Okay.
And I felt I needed the change of framework and the break. And it was a good time for Geronimo Productions as well, because there's Punky going on, and there's a new show which is going to the Cartoon Forum this September called Nelly and Nora, which is absolutely gorgeous. It's a lovely, lovely show. And Planet Cosmo is just beginning to build international sales. And so for one of the first times in many, many years, I was looking at the studio and thinking, well, this place has its own momentum. You know, I could actually walk out today and the studio will do just fine. It won't miss me, you know? So it just felt like a good time for me, a good time for the studio. Yeah. And yeah, so I'm going to be starting to look at new opportunities. And at the moment, really, I'm just exploring the options.
Yeah, makes sense.
Now, my main aim will always be to deliver something really good to preschool kids. That one way or another, that's going to be my mission.
Yeah, whatever it is.
Yeah, but the form of that and how I do that, I'm exploring options.
Let's watch this space.
Exactly.
Excellent.
Yes.
Well, thank you for all this. This is a great interview.
Oh,
and
thank you.
Best of luck in all your sort of future endeavors.
Thank you very much, Aidan.
Great stuff.
Cheers.
All right, we hope you enjoyed episode 5, and thanks so much again to Jason for giving us this interview.
As I mentioned in the interview, Jason has a great blog, kind of production blog, full of lots of interesting tips and tricks and things like that, and it's great. I'd recommend it. It's jasontamamagi.com. Also, a few TV times for the shows we were talking about. A lot of those shows now are on RTE Junior in Ireland, so every weekday you can see on RTE Junior Punky at 8:40, Rhubarb and Custard is on at 11:05 and 3:40, and Fluffy Gardens is on at 1:15 and 4:45. Jason's new show Planet Cosmo is on at 10 minutes past 9 on RTE2.
Fantastic. And thank you so much again for everybody who entered into our Facebook competition.
Oh, yes.
We have exciting news that Tim Dowling
has
won the magnificent book. So that will be winging its way to you soon, Tim.
If you want to get in touch with the podcast, it's flipped@gmail.com. You can, of course, still like our Facebook page, facebook.com/flippedpodcast. If you want to tweet at me, I'm at Aidan McAteer.
And I'm at the Meg Bar.
And if you enjoyed the podcast, tell your friends and come on back next month for another exciting adventure.
Really exciting.
right.
Talk to you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
The Flipped Animation Podcast was produced by Megan McMahon and Aidan McAteer, edited by Aidan McAteer, and featured music from royaltyfreemusiclibrary.com. For more information, visit our website at flippedpodcast.com.